Welcome to Spider on the Web number 19. Like all of them, this episode is being podcast under Creative Commons license, no derivatives, non-commercial, share alike. This week we break new ground with used but timeless material. So far, Spider on the Web has brought you science fact, science fiction, and some music that's out of this world. Now it's time for some of what I call speculative non-fiction, a science fiction writer's take on real-world events, a futurist's thoughts on the recent past. From 1996 to 2004, I had a roughly tri-weekly op-ed column in Canada's national newspaper, The Globe and Mail. It began under the title The Crazy Years, in honor of Robert A. Heinlein's prediction in his famous future history chart, that at about this point in history, mankind was going to collectively lose its marbles for a little while. Later, I adopted a brilliant suggestion by astronomer Jamie Matthews and retitled the column Past Imperfect, Future Tense, and after 9/11, future tense came to seem sufficient. I'll give you a few examples of the kind of thing I mean. And don't worry, I haven't forgotten last week's promise that this episode would tell you how to acquire the best music of the past century, not just free, but guilt-free, without ripping off a single musician. We'll get to that shortly. But first, my daughter Terry and my wife Jeannie both asked me to open with the same column. That takes care of that. It was written on November 8th, 2000, and I slugged it, Evil's Root Killer, or Brother, Can You Spare a Paradigm? Copyright 2000 by Spider Robinson. Once this planet was owned jointly by Portugal and Spain. Most Terrans did not know that at the time, but it was true nonetheless. My source is literally infallible. In 1494, Pope Alexander VI drew a line across a map and declared with the authority of God that this side belonged to Spain and that side to Portugal. No, really. And Alexander's ruling was effective. If you've ever wondered why Brazilians speak Portuguese, that's why. Brazil happened to lie on that side of the papal perimeter. Spain had Columbus and conquistadors. Portugal had great navigators. And together they divvied up the incalculable wealth of the New World. So, today Spain and Portugal are the two most powerful nations on Earth, their mighty economies the bedrock of Western commerce, their languages spoken by all civ... Oops. What happened? Half a millennium later, the former co-rulers of Earth are second-rate powers at best. What ruined them? War? Plague? Intrigue? Money. Specifically, all those shiploads of treasure you've read about in 100 books, seen in a dozen movies. Gold, silver, emeralds. Sure, lots ended up on the bottom of the ocean, but all too much made it home. Spain and Portugal were suddenly rich. Unfortunately, they were rich in money, not wealth. Gold is not wealth. Gold is what you use to buy wealth. Wealth is desired consumables. Corn, wheat, iron ore, potable water, arable land convenient to a market, stuff you couldn't ship across the Atlantic in the 16th century. The two Iberian superpowers got tons of new money, but almost no real new wealth. Economics 101, too many pesetas and escudos, chasing too few potatoes, is a recipe for disaster. Massive inflation, balance of trade collapse, currency devaluation, both economies went to hell and stayed there. Too much money can actually destroy wealth. So turn it around. What happens to money if the supply of wealth should suddenly become infinite? Time to start thinking about it, because if nanotechnology works even half as well as its advocates hope, and so far all the signs are good, we may have near-infinite wealth sometime within the coming century. And if it comes, it will come all at once. I know, early nuclear power enthusiasts once promised energy too cheap to meter. This is fundamentally different, by many orders of magnitude. Nanotechnology hopes to build molecules atom by atom, and thus produce objects that basically grow themselves out of free parts. If it works, the day I finish programming a stem cell nanoassembler to make, say, yachts on command, the effective cost of such a yacht plunges to zero. Everywhere. I can send that Assembler Seeds instruction set to Tasmania instantly and cheaply, the same way I file this column, over the Internet. Load that set into an invisibly tiny, self-replicating assembler there, and it will make free yachts from random Tasmanian atoms just as easily as mine does from Canadian atoms. All God's children got atoms. Sooner or later, the same will apply to absolutely any commodity which can be made from molecules. Everything humans buy or sell except original art, sex, and other personal services, in other words. We'll all be totally rich. There will simply be too much wealth to steal. Want it to literally rain soup? No problem. How about a whiskey shower for dessert? If all those Porsches are cluttering your lawn, tell them to disassemble themselves. As for real estate, by God, we will make more, as much as we want. Money is basically a scheme for keeping score in a presumed zero-sum game. We collect it to protect ourselves from famine or other scarcity. It exists only because scarcity exists. Once we're all infinitely rich, there will be no real use for this stuff. We'll have to quit the habit of trading work for what we want. There simply won't be enough work to go around. For a while, programming various skills into nano-assemblers or designing new products will constitute useful work, but these are clearly finite tasks, and ones which people capable of them will probably do for the fun and prestige of it. If you think the dawn of the information age has been disorienting, wait till you see the age of plenty. In the last century, humanity has slowly and painfully begun weaning itself from imperialism, genocide, racism, slavery, religious tyranny. Hell, we've even begun trying to stop abusing our own spouses and children. But wait until we have to give up money. And all those funky things that grow in the damp shadows beneath it. Class structure. Snobbery. Poverty as social control. Income as proof of character. Wealth as license to misbehave. Many of the truly hateful things about the world as it presently is, if not most of them, derive from scarcity. And before the end of the century, we might just run plumb out of the stuff. I suspect we'll find the conquest of death far less traumatic than the death of money. Science fiction has often imagined long life, but seldom universal wealth. Well, that would be wishful thinking, dreaming an impossible dream. Like predicting an end to the Cold War, or apartheid, or smallpox. As with any profound change, it's the transition period that'll be the worst. Some of the most profoundly sick people our species ever produced, those addicted to pushing other people around, will be forced into mental health for want of victims. Then they'll go kicking and screaming. It'll be worse than all the junkies in history going into withdrawal at once. How will the Donald Trumps of tomorrow prove their superior worth, majesty, and importance without cash for a codpiece? What if ruthlessness and avarice themselves became obsolete? Pointless. Closer to home, how will we persuade other people to perform services, like making up interesting stories for us, if not by simply waving money, universal irresistible catnip, under their noses? Well, I think we're just going to have to try asking them nicely, or devoting a little thought to what they might want or need and performing some service for them. The Golden Rule, we'll probably still call it, long after everyone's forgotten why gold used to be thought so important. Well, I can see why Terry and Jeannie both like that one. It's the sort of happy, optimistic prediction you're likely to see in my science fiction, not so much in my commentary on the news. For a slightly more caustic viewpoint on what we are pleased to miscall an educational system, try this one. It was titled, School Will Be Ending Next Month, but it was written in August of 2003. In August, school is at the very bottom of the list of things any healthy child wants to think about, well below poetry, hemorrhoids, and the heat death of the universe. Why? Society's default answer is because modern children are lazy, irresponsible hedonists, and school represents hard work and serious, i.e. difficult, thought. These would indeed be excellent reasons to hate school, but they miss the point. As summer rounds the clubhouse turn, every teenager in the land is working as hard as hell, learning things hand over fist. Useful, important, practical, fascinating things about life as she has actually lived. And in another month, they'll once again be reined in and locked away for 9 months in a place where almost nothing they're compelled to learn will be of any perceptible use. For a North American liberal arts education, I think mine was fairly broad and deep. It was certainly varied. Catholic school, nuns, until first grade. Catholic high school, brothers, with junior year spent in a seminary. 2 years of Catholic college, priests, and 5 more years of secular university, all resulting barely in a B.A. In addition to extensive studies in English literature and composition, I was taught physics, chemistry, biology, astronomy, 6 kinds of mathematics, history, geography, geology, sociology, French, philosophy, psychology, economics, linguistics, and probably 6 other things I've omitted. Of all these, the only course I have used often, and expect to use often in future, is a biology course I took in my last year of university. It was taught by the department chairman, Dr. Elof Axel Carlson, and titled Biology for Liberal Arts Majors Who Need a Science Credit. In it, he told us about the startling big developments in biology that were going to come along and change our lives in the next 20 or 30 years, and invited us to plan how we would handle them when they arrived. I've thought of him every year since. I named the villain of my first novel after him. That and cockiness are all I have to show for 19 years of, trust me, expensive education. Here's a very partial list of the utterly essential life skills school did not teach me, would not have dreamed of teaching me, which I had to learn myself by trial and painful error. How to cook. Yes, we made muffins and home ec. That has nothing to do with how to cook. Nobody ever taught me, for instance, that the secret of perfect bacon is to cook it in the nude, so you won't set the heat too high. How to do simple household plumbing and carpentry. I don't mean making an ashtray and shop. I mean how to make the damn tap stop dripping. How to build a fire. How a 90-year-old man splits firewood. How to balance a checkbook, and what to do when it cannot be balanced. How to fill out a tax form, with particular attention to red flags that commonly trigger an audit. How to start a business. How to operate a business. How to fold a business. How to buy a car or house without getting burned. How to drive, not as a short extracurricular offering, but as a serious, in-depth, year-long study with simulators, intensive training in proper emergency reflexes, tours of morgues and burn wards, etc. Basic and advanced first aid for common emergencies. When to kowtow to a bureaucrat and when to bully him. How to bully a bureaucrat, one of the most underappreciated skills in the Western world. How and when to offer someone a bribe. What to do if you're arrested. What not to do. How to lie effectively and elegantly, useful in every profession and occupation. How to spot the lies in a commercial, ad, speech, newscast, or newspaper column. How to spot the traps, cons, and loopholes in a legal contract. Perhaps these last 4 items could be bundled together under the heading of bullshit detection. How to find the third harmony in a song. How to apologize. How to give a good back rub and foot rub. How to drink. Oh, for God's sake, how hypocritical can we be? We all know they're going to do it. Why must they fumble their way to responsible drinking? Why must their experiments be utterly unsupervised? Which drugs are really dangerous and which are really harmless? Really. How to cool conflict, calm rage, diffuse tension, keep a crowd from becoming a mob. How to handle a drunk. When and how to demonstrate, the rights and obligations of a demonstrator. When and how to meditate, anything whatsoever to do with spirituality, really, as distinct from religion. how to deal with a racist, religionist, or sexist joke, how to make a difference in local politics, how to organize generally, how to type, and how to use a computer effectively. Again, not as a brief summer elective, but as a serious subject. How to research. How to use the library, newspaper, morgue, museum, county courthouse, people, and oh yeah, the internet. Some of the important universal truths of the universe that are not self-evident and don't seem to fall into any particular subject's jurisdiction. Here's one, for instance, that for some ridiculous reason can take a man decades to figure out on his own. Anger always, always turns out to be fear disguised. If you're enraged, you're terrified. Or here's another that actively contradicts some of what they taught you in physics. Shared pain is lessened, and shared joy is increased. If I'm hurting, and I share it with you, somehow we end up with less than half a hurt apiece. If you share your joy with me, somehow it more than doubles. Awesome. And another, so counterintuitive you might never stumble across it without help. When you're at rock bottom, at the very end of your rope, the thing to do is find somebody worse off and help him. Let teachers teach stuff like this, and I guarantee kids will come to school early and stay after class voluntarily. All right, I've been talking for nearly 20 minutes straight. Time to break this up with some music. And this composer/performer belonged in my very first musical podcast last week. I just ran out of time. I listen to his music all the time when I write, and even more often when I'm at a stuck place and can't write. I put on one of his CDs and fire up a screensaver called Electric Sheep and stare at it and listen, and shortly I know what the next sentence should be. The only other musician I find equally effective for this is Frank Zappa. Like Frank's guitar solos, this cat's work strongly rewards close attention but does not demand it. It fully occupies the part of my mind that usually makes up reasons to stop writing and go make more coffee, while comforting and informing the rest. I'm speaking of my friend, webmaster, and occasional Zen sitting buddy, postmodern saxophonist and composer Colin McDonald of Vancouver. Like my wife Jeannie, he is a lay-ordained Soto Zen Buddhist monk in the Dharma lineage of Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, and he's a well-known figure on the contemporary music scene here in Canada. His interests range from classical to jazz to Balinese gamelan music, at which he is unusually proficient. I'm going to play you a 9-minute piece aptly called Thaumaturgy. About 4 minutes in, it will get so quiet you could be excused for wondering if it's another dead-air technical glitch like the one I put in last week. Hang in there, because his ending is going to knock your socks off. It will sound like Colin plays for over 4 minutes straight without breathing. That's because he does. Thank you. Now, anybody out there need to be told that thaumaturgy means the working of wonders and miracles? Magic? If you'd like to know how a human being can do that, and how long it takes to learn, and how insanely hard learning is, pick up a new paperback copy of Variable Star. In its latter pages, you'll find an extensive description of circular breathing, as the trick is called, and for that entire sequence, and all other saxophone lore in that novel, my expert source was Colin McDonald. I regret to say that if you would like to buy some of Colin's music, you're going to have to pretty much beat it out of him. Like many geniuses, he is a perfectionist and unhappy with every bit of his music so far recorded. I own about 24 CDs of his work with groups of assorted kinds and sizes, and enjoy every one of them, but I have so far been unsuccessful in persuading him to sell any out of his website, www.crypticmusic.ca, either as MP3 downloads or as CDs through the mail. Perhaps if you write to him there, you'll have better luck than I have. Okay, I was raving a few minutes ago about things they didn't teach you in school. Well, I got a real good one, so gather around and let me school you a minute. I aim to earn your donation this week. This is one of the best lessons I've been given in years. How to BitTorrent to download fantastic music free without guilt. I got schooled by a friend in Hamburg, Herr Jens Stark. I had heard about the world of BitTorrenting, or peer-to-peer, or whatever you want to call music sharing on the internet. But what I'd mostly heard was that it rips off musicians. Well, hell, I'm a musician, albeit an unsuccessful one. Even worse, some of my best friends are musicians, and the bastards were all starting to try and borrow money from me. Finally, there's always talk of imminent crackdowns, and I didn't want to end up named in any torrents warrants. They can get you shipped off to Iraq, the famous Warrants of Arabia. You wascoey wabbits. No, finally, I heard it was for serious computer geeks only. Then Jens turned me on to the tracker site dimeadozen.org and told me how anybody bright enough to use Google can take advantage of it. You say you want the greatest music ever made, free, without guilt or hassle? That's right. Here's the lick. First, you need a BitTorrent client, which just means an application that will suck down BitTorrents onto your hard drive and then upload them back to others who want them until you've repaid what you took. There are a ton of BitTorrent clients. Google the string, quote, BitTorrent client, unquote, plus, quote, freeware, unquote, plus, quote, your operating system, Windows or Mac or whatever, unquote, and then pick one. On my Mac, my only area of expertise, I've used Bits on Wheels. I didn't care for it, found it slow and clunky. Azurius, much better, my favorite so far, but then the idiot sent an automatically loading upgrade that torpedoed it completely and forever. And Transmission, not quite as good as Azurius, but it works, and it isn't as bad as Bits on Wheels. I'm using it right now. Anyway, you hunt around till you've got your client of choice. Now you're looking for some great torrents to download. Well, there are a dozen really great sites and 100 okay ones for special purposes. But the one I use over 95% of the time, and browse on a weekly basis at least, is www.dimeadozen.org. Note, membership is free, but it can take as long as an entire day of repeated attempts to become one of their over 100,000 members. It took me 3 hours late at night, but it will be the best musical day you ever spent. All Dime torrents are 100% guilt-free and include treasures beyond imagining, no matter what your musical tastes. They cater to all genres, even rap. You'll find recent recordings of Tuvan throat singing in New Jersey there and Paul McCartney's latest BBC TV concert. Airway, who created and runs dimeadozen.org, is fanatically rigid about four principles, relentlessly so, in fact. One, you must never, ever sell anything you download on pain of lifetime ban. Two, the torrent's contents must not be commercially available anywhere on Earth. If 5 seconds of a torrent ever get included on an album or DVD that will earn the artist a penny, that torrent is pulled at once and stays out until it has been revised to delete the offending material. You couldn't buy this stuff if you tried. Three, the artist must not object to the torrent's posting for any reason or no reason at all. If so, it is pulled at once and forever. I know of more than one big name who deliberately leaks concert soundboard recordings as they happen to promote the concert tour and boost album sales. Others are starting to wise up. Four, regardless of the sound quality of the original, which ranges from listenable to unbelievably superb, depending on vintage, audio is uploaded only in the form of lossless FLAC files, which will play back perfectly even if you download them over a flaky phone connection and lose half the data to line noise, and they actually ask you to please never share them with anyone else in some shitty format like MP3. This calls for a small digression. Converting FLAC files to something you can use is an extra step, but a painless one and well worth it. Google, quote, FLAC conversion, unquote, plus, quote, freeware, unquote, plus, quote, your OS, unquote. On my Mac, I use a painless free widget called Xact, X-A-C-T, that quickly decodes FLAC to either AIFF, standard commercial CD format, or WAV, just as good, same file size. Then I burn them to CD with the brilliant program Toast Titanium, or add the CD to my iTunes, which converts it to much smaller AAC files my ears can't distinguish from the original, making it possible to email tracks to friends, without using some shitty format like MP3. So, okay, you browse Dime's torrents and find one so exciting you can barely contain yourself. A daily occurrence. A DVD of the Kenny Barron Trio doing an evening at Jazz Baltica Festival in Germany 8 years ago, say. You click on it and are taken to a page that tells you A, contents details, B, size in megabytes, C, uploaders and downloaders comments or questions, and D, how actively it's being snatched right now. The Cedars comments tell you this DVD is in European PAL format rather than North American NTSC. Your DVD player probably will not play it unless it's a very good one, but your computer's onboard DVD player will play it just fine, whether Mac or Windows. And the comments tell you that this particular DVD includes an optional 5.1 surround audio channel, and the Leecher's comments consist of ecstatic raves about its surpassing awesomeness. So, these torrent details inflame you beyond control, and you click on that torrent. It, not the music, mind you, but a very little file describing that particular music, immediately downloads to wherever you've told your browser to download things to. When you've chosen all the torrents you want for one day, close your browser, open up your BitTorrent application of choice, and then go to your downloads folder. Get the torrent file you want to snatch, and just drag its icon over onto the application's window. It'll ask where you want the snatched file put, create a folder for that, and click OK. That's it. You're done. Go do something else with your computer, or go fishing. The client will keep silently chugging away in the background for an hour, a week, whatever it takes. If you were downloading, like, more than a dozen DVDs at once while trying to watch a YouTube video, you'd notice the video pausing to rebuffer often enough to be annoying. But you can always hop over to your BitTorrent client and pause it. Some torrents arrive in less than an hour. Some are being uploaded by a guy with a telephone connection who's only online 2 hours a day, and they take a week or more. What do you care? It would take that long to get it from Amazon. If only you could get this stuff from Amazon. Well, in the fullness of time, your torrent is done. You burn it to disk, import it to your iTunes, whatever you like, and leave it exactly where it is, untouched, ideally until your client tells you that its ratio has exceeded 1.0. That means it's been uploaded as often as you download it. Then trash it and the original tiny file pointing to it and move on. And by the way, the 5.1 surround on the Kenny Barron DVD is better than being in the front row that night would have been. Better than being in the trio that night. It's like being invisible on stage right in the middle of the trio, equidistant from the three musicians, somehow without disturbing them. Now, about burning the results. All this advice is Macintosh only. For CDs, I use either iTunes or Toast Titanium. Both are simple and bulletproof. DVDs will most often arrive in the form of a folder containing another folder always called Video_TS. And perhaps some other bonus files like artwork or comments, but ignore them for now. Almost always, the Video_TS folder will be less than 4.3 gigabytes in size, small enough to fit on a blank DVD. Open Toast Titanium, click on Other, and from the resulting menu choose DVD. Name the DVD. Drag the Video TS folder and nothing else onto that window. Click Record and insert a blank DVD. As the British say, Robert is the sibling of one or more of your parents. By the way, apropos of nothing, if you were to, accidentally I'm sure, put a rented or purchased commercial DVD into your Mac, quit out a DVD player, and open a Googleable application called Mac the Ripper, it would rip that DVD's contents, removing annoying copy protection as it goes, to your hard drive, where they would take the form of a folder called Video_TS, such as we've been discussing, only much too big to burn onto a blank disk with titanium, typically 7 to 8 gigabytes. Well, there's nothing illegal about ripping a DVD to your own hard drive in an unburnable form, is there? By an interesting coincidence, though, the equally Googleable application DVD21X2 can now take that huge Video_TS folder and with one click compress it and burn it onto a blank DVD. If you tell it to, it'll include all director's comments, special features, foreign language, soundtracks, subtitles, etc. Nothing illegal about burning contents of your own hard drive, compressed for convenience, onto backup disks, one video at a time. And I'm sure you would never, ever do it with copyrighted material, such as commercial movies or TV or music, which can be located in large variety at a number of tracker sites I'm sure you can Google for yourself. But seriously, they have none of dimeadozen.org's rigid rules, so you really want to be careful visiting such sites. With the best intentions in the world, meaning only to download this one movie that you actually bought once in VHS and lost, or find this one album that may be technically available commercially but in practice is unobtainable, but suddenly you scroll down one screen too far and find yourself offered something like the entire Verve Jazz Masters collection. 60 CDs of the best of 100 years of jazz in a single torrent. Or say, the total studio recordings by Mahavishnu John McLaughlin, his entire life work and total capital, over 50 CDs. Or every episode of The West Wing. Back your one ton up to the loading dock, dude. I mean, are you prepared to resist that kind of temptation to steal? Me, I break out in a cold sweat and hop back over to Dime a Dozen. Most of the time. But when, say, I've spent a lifetime earnestly trying to pay someone, anyone, to give me solo CDs by Joel Gilberto, and amassed a total of two, and then some helpful stranger offers me a dozen, free, off the back of a very nice-looking truck. Joel, I'm sorry, but think how many people I can turn on to your music now. Surely some of them live somewhere they can buy your records, right? See how easy it is to rationalize this shit? Better to stick with Dime a Dozen and others of its ilk, and sleep well at night. About uploading material from your own private collection, I confess I haven't done it once yet, and won't soon. Many don't. The procedure for converting to FLAC and encoding it for seeding is much trickier than converting such files back to normal again, and for as long as you're seeding it, you have to stop all downloads. And they demand so much research on venue, date, sidemen, source, and scrupulous verification of commercial non-availability that I finally just filed it under Nagana, from the Sanskrit Nag, or fuck, and the Hittite Una, or that course of action. Nobody minds as long as you at least reseed what you've leached. Important note, though, soothe your ISP. Check the fine print in your agreement with your internet service provider before you get too far into this. I didn't, and they were quite reasonable about educating me. But your mileage may vary. It turns out that their cheapest plan, the one I use, they specifically limit the amount of data I may upload and or download, they don't care which, it's all traffic to them, each month to a max of 60 gigabytes. Go much over that for 2 months in a row, and they'll start demanding more money. So, I shouldn't download more than 30 gigabytes a month if I intend to give it all back, like a good cyber citizen. That comes to roughly 7 to 10 DVDs, or 90 CDs. Call it 3 albums a day, or 2 concert DVDs a week. Yeah, I guess I can get by on that. What you can get? Not just rarities and collectors' treasured bootlegs going back as far as the 1920s. But in some cases, a live concert that was performed last night and that will download faster than it took to occur by artists like Kenny Barron or Crosby and Nash or the great Joao Basco or Eric Clapton. The video/audio quality can in rare cases be horrible, say in a bootleg video shot from the last row at a George Harrison concert with a cheap vidcam, but precious beyond rating for historical or personal value. And far more often, it's just as good as the artist's last official concert DVD release, perhaps even the unused outtakes cut from it. That's basically it. Pass it on. After a lifetime of drought conditions, the skies have opened and it is raining God's favorite music. Pouring monsoon strength. Grab yourself a bucket. In the last month or two, I bagged the following DVDs. Miles Davis Quintet on the Steve Allen Show, first recording ever of Wayne Shorter with the group. Jeff Beck in Tokyo, 2 discs, over 3 hours. Kenny Barron Quintet doing a whole evening of Brazilian music with Romero Lubamba. Johnny Winter in the 1970s, 2 discs. A Captain Beefheart documentary, Portable People. a superb new documentary about the life of Frank Zappa from Dutch television with English subtitles, including interviews with everyone who ever loved him or ever played with him or stood next to him, featuring footage of a solo that frightened Steve Vai. Charlie Hayden with Carla Bley and the reunited New Liberation Orchestra in Europe, musically apologizing on behalf of America for George W. Bush, as they once did for Richard Nixon. The great Elise Regina in 1973, sitting in a Sao Paulo studio with a black-and-white camera a meter from her face for 90 minutes while she sings and talks of her life in Portuguese, backed by a small rhythm section including her husband, Maria Rita's father, Cesar Camargo Mariano. Riveting. B.B. King, Marsha Ball, and others at the Clinton White House. The first Clinton White House. A glorious PBS documentary on Les Paul at age 90, just awesome beyond describing. It opens as the Smithsonian arrives at his house to carry away the first ever multi-track recording machine, the first reverb, the first sound-on-sound recording machine, the first electric guitar. To this day, the man drives into New York City from his home in New Jersey every Monday night and plays with whoever shows up. I also scored, just in the past few months, CDs, pure audio, mind you, of live performances by Wayne Shorter, Daryl Scott, Professor Longhair, Paul Butterfield, Leon Russell, Lambert Hendrickson Ross, Gonzalo Rubalcaba, Gillian Welsh, Gilberto Gil, Caetano Veloso, Bonnie Raitt, Bobby Gentry, hosting her own BBC TV show back in the day. It features the very first ever TV performance by a 20-year-old James Taylor. Trigilchin, the Tuban throat singers I mentioned before, just awesome. And a 1960 home recording by five young men, then calling themselves Johnny and the Moondogs, who would one day become, as James Taylor calls them, the Four Singing Beatles, the only recording known with Stu Sutcliffe audible. He sucked, by the way. Plus, over 30 hours of Marion McPartland's magnificent NPR radio program, Piano Jazz. Each an hour with a single guest, half interviews, half solos and duets. Guests like Ray Charles, Les Paul, Willie Nelson, Blossom Dearie, Tony Bennett. I'll stop now. That's a typical couple of months at dimeadozen.org. All this downloaded while I was doing other things, like preparing and recording this podcast. Now that I've brightened your life a little, it's time to see how many people I can manage to piss off with a single column. Please bear in mind that this column was written in April 2002, long before eminent scientists like Richard Dawkins began publishing books with a similar theme. In honor of the above-mentioned James Taylor, I called it You Just Can't Kill for Jesus / Allah / Yahweh / Rama / Elvis. God is omniscient, omnipotent, and omnibenevolent. It says so right here on the label. If you have a mind capable of believing all three of these divine attributes simultaneously, I have a wonderful bargain for you. No checks, please. Cash, and in small bills. Unquote, Robert Anton Heinlein. A few years ago, we finally persuaded psychiatrists to remove homosexuality from the list of recognized mental disorders. Maybe it's time we started lobbying them to add belief in God to the list. Belief in an angry, intolerant one, anyway. I'm told 81% of Canadians believe in God, or at least claim to when asked by a pollster whose expression makes it clear the only other possible stance is Satanism. I believe what that statistic actually means is that most of my fellow Canadians realize the universe is larger than themselves, sense there is something higher and better to aspire to, yearn for a deeper understanding of suffering and mortality, have difficulty accepting that 12 billion years of blindly bumping particles just happened to produce their love's left eyelash and Lennon and McCartney, and or are capable of awe and wonder. I refuse to accept that 4 out of 5 of my neighbors believe in a bearded paranoid in the sky who enjoys having his feet regularly washed in the blood of heathens and licked clean, and plans to torture most humans for eternity. It seems to me that if a religion decides, with an entire planet to pick from, to select as its most sacred spot one already in use by another religion and to kill for possession of it, then and there that religion is disqualified. Revealed to be bogus, whatever else it professes or does, until the day it recants. It cannot be a genuine bona fide religion if it permits, much less requires, spilling human blood for God. It must be either a fraud or a severe mental disorder. If the religion already in possession of the sacred spot spills civilian blood to keep the place, they're disqualified too. Any shaman who believes God wants children orphaned or maimed over the zip code of his temple is by definition out of touch with God, incompetent to practice. I'm calling for minimal standards of shamanic competence. Physicians must swear to first do no harm before we let them use a scalpel on so much as a dead frog. It's time we started requiring that much of our soul doctors. First, kill no unbelievers. Any faith that won't go at least that far should forfeit tax-exempt status. All four of the world's major religions are presently in disgrace, and all are hip-deep in denial. How many Arab imams have publicly denounced suicide bombing? How many Israeli rabbis have loudly repudiated provocative settlement? How many Hindu or Muslim leaders in India have spoken out against the madness there? How many Catholic cardinals have condemned abortionist murderers, bishops covering for pedophile priests, or Pius X's quiet complicity in the Holocaust? I'm sick of all four allegedly godly gangs. I don't even use their product, and I'm disgusted by the shoddy merchandise they peddle. I demand assurances that a given religion will not cause or potentiate mass homicidal psychosis or priestly pedophilia before we let it indoctrinate helpless children and vulnerable adults. Bloodthirsty, authoritarian theology threatens Canada as much as tobacco, obesity, and booze put together, and endangers our planet more than global warming, nuclear winter, or rogue asteroids. I have not been what most would call religious since I left a Catholic seminary at 15. Still a virgin, oddly. But I get along very well with people who are religious, even profoundly so. I'm prepared to prove it. I've been happily married to a monk for 27 years now. I am not a Buddhist myself. I use Irish whiskey. But I respect my lay-ordained wife's Soto Zen faith highly. As far as I can tell, Buddhists don't seem to go in for holy war, though there are as many flavors of Buddhism as there are sects of Christianity. Get a Buddhist totally outraged, and he tends to set himself on fire, taking care for bystanders downwind. Siddhartha Gautama's message has spread across the planet not by blood and conquest, but by example and adaptation, altering to fit the local culture as it passed from India through Tibet to China, thence to Japan, and most recently to North America. Most Buddhists seem far more interested in achieving the real state than in acquiring real estate. I note, too, that Buddhism is one of the rare religions that does not have a central god, though Tibetan, Korean, and Burmese varieties, for instance, did incorporate pre-existing pantheons of gods and demons. Buddha himself is not divine. The name means only awakened one. The historical Buddha was the seventh in a series of 21 Buddhas. There is no uber daddy, no paradise to bribe with, no hellfire to threaten with, no Satan, great or small. There are hells, but they're states of mind. Tolerance appears built into Buddhism's very bones. It seeks only freedom from delusion. Buddhists may belong to other religions. That sort of says it all. I don't object to people believing silly things. I believe some silly things myself. Where I draw the line, where I suggest all civilized residents of this crowded starship must soon draw the line, is the point at which someone's god tells him to go kill those unbelievers in the next valley. That's the basic litmus test I'm proposing. A god who says he wants you so much as arguing theology with your neighbor, much less trading punches, let alone bullets, is not God at all, but 1, a damnable hypocrisy invented to excuse villainy, or 2, the same voice all the other schizophrenics hear if they stop taking their medication. My friend Stephen Gaskin once said, Religions only look different if you get them retail. But if you go to a wholesaler, you'll find it all comes from the same distributor anyway. Fine with me, but I want minimal consumer safety standards instituted in the metaphysical marketplace. Caveat emptor, just isn't working. All right, time to break things up with a little musical interlude again, and because the subject was just theology, I'll give you a track called Gospel Lullaby. Let me tell you a little bit about the cat who blows it. To do that, I have to tell you about the last time that I was in the city of New Orleans, or probably ever will be again now. Jeannie and I had been invited to a science fiction convention in New Orleans, and part of the deal was we had a week beforehand to hang out in the quarter. We'd been to New Orleans several times before, mostly spent our time in the quarter because we were just never there long enough to get to know any local people. But we knew a good time could be had, because if you can't have a good time in the French Quarter, brother, you dead. And we arrived and we checked into a hotel, I believe it's called the Villa Contento, one of the several places that claims to be the original house of the rising sun. And the very first thing that happened was I got sick as a dog and took to my bed and stayed there for the entire goddamn week. And I mean so sick, it was a real major hassle to make it to the head and back to the bed. Jeannie, frustrated beyond endurance, went out and had as good a time as she could have by herself in the quarter, knowing that there was somebody back in the hotel room who was moaning and dying. And she'd come back at night and try and be what comfort she could. I felt like an idiot. And finally, God be praised, on the very last day of our week there, the siege lifted just a little bit, and I felt like I might be able to stagger down the street and, get me a little drink somewhere, see if I could drown the germs. So we made it to, I'm pretty sure it was Bourbon Street, but I can't swear to it, and we walked into a club, and we sat down, and a cat come out, just looked like Mr. New Orleans himself, and he began to blow. Now, if you would like to see this man in action, you can download a torrent from dimeadozen.org of his work just in the last year with Elvis Costello and Alan Toussaint. He blows baritone sax in the Crescent City Horns, who were touring with Alan and Elvis this past year. His name is Brian Breeze Kaol. He sings, he plays the saxophone, he composes. And I'm going to play a track called Gospel Lullaby. This is the kind of music I heard as I sat there after a week of horrifying illness in New Orleans. This is the music that put me together and healed me. On my very last night in New Orleans, it will always be my quintessential New Orleans memory, and it looks like the last one I'm ever going to have, because Breeze got washed out by Katrina like so many others and is now living in Memphis, where he's working with a group called the New Lost City Ramblers. Look, they're going to make some fine music. But here's the man himself back in the day in New Orleans playing a composition of his own from the album State of My Heart, Gospel Lullaby by Breeze Kaol. Thank you. Yes, Lord. Well, I'll tell you, friends, I took so much strength and sustenance from the power of his horn and his soul and his voice that I burned his name deep into my brain. As soon as I got home, I looked him up on the web, tried to find a website for him, and failed. But every year after that, at least two or three times a year, his name would pop into my head, and I'd Google him up again. And finally it worked, and I found www.kol.com, where you can get that album, State of My Heart, and another one. That was Breeze Kol, and now that I put a warm breeze into your winter night, I'm going to leave you with a kind of a chill breeze up your underwear, a column written in 2003 called Whatever. It's a turnkey operation. One size fits all. Plug and play. Who am I this week? Whatever. The computer salesman knows nothing about computers any more than the bookseller reads. They were both selling shoes last week. Next week they'll be selling timeshares. Whatever. The company is totally controlled by stockholders who will never pass through the town the factory is located in and have not the vaguest idea of what product the factory makes. For that matter, few of the people at the factory care whether the product they're making is any damn good. They're thinking ahead to their next job because they know their real employers are a pack of passing looters they'll never meet. Whatever. Call your insurance company and the phone will be answered by someone in Atlanta. Call the same number the next day and you'll speak to someone in Seattle who has no record of or interest in your previous call. The Minister of Health will be the Minister of Forestry next year and Minister of Defense the year after that. Nobody even thinks this is weird. The marketing department could care less what the product is. Whatever. All the cars look identical to one another, probably because they're all identical to one another. You want to go where anybody knows your name. Before you know it, you're in a mind space where you start to get a warm, fuzzy feeling from dialing up Amazon.com, because no matter how long you've been away, the Amazon robot will always remember your tastes in music and can remind you. Whatever. Disconnect. We all crave freedom, avoid entanglement, strive to evade definition, and thus know less and less about what we're doing. Nobody would be caught dead actually caring about something. We're coming to be like bits in a computer chip, not much caring whether we're zeros or ones, much less whether the pattern of zeros or ones we're part of represents a spreadsheet or a love letter. There is more beauty and dignity in a hoe or rake. Even a chamber pot has a purpose. My former brother-in-law Clark Spangler designed synthesizers. The first time he went to Japan to inspect the Yamaha factory that was producing his famous CS model, he was considerably startled by how incredibly proud everybody he met there was, proud of their job, their product, and their company. On the assembly line, he met a man who, he still maintains, was unmistakably the happiest man on the face of the planet. This little guy's entire job consisted of standing beside a conveyor belt, and as widgets came endlessly by, picking them up and tightening the third screw from the top, he told me. He did this all day long, every day, had done this all his life, and he was just so serenely, self-evidently, transcendently happy that when other workers had problems, they used to like to stand around near him just to take a hit. Fascinated, Clark spent time with the man, curious to understand the source of this unfailing joy. "It turned out to be so simple," he says. "This fellow knew for a fact, right down to his souls, that he was the very best third screw from the top of a widget tightener there was." How many of us sophisticates can even comprehend that kind of pride? What do we have to be proud of? "Not much is needed to destroy a man. Merely persuade him that his labors are useless." Dostoevsky. How many of us do anything actually useful anymore? And what of those who do? The nurses are useful and deserve to be proud. But they must spend a large and growing portion of every day explaining to helpless people in pain that they will not be getting what they deserve because it simply isn't there to be gotten, because the tax money intended to pay for it was stolen. Hard to be proud of that, even though they know it's not their fault. The same with the teachers. They're past masters at making bricks without straw, and nonetheless, every day they must shortchange the students they love because they've been given no choice. Donating massively of their own time and money isn't always enough to restore the pride they deserve to enjoy. The police have every right to be proud, but along with all the good they do, they're also required to help force prostitutes into the control of pimps, enforce hideously absurd drug laws that generate most of the crime in the first place, wave drunken drivers through the system and back out onto the highway, and sometimes mace crowds of protesting citizens at the behest of creeps in expensive suits. Such things erode pride. The social workers ought to be proudest of all, the proudest people in our whole society, for they do the work of nurses, teachers, and police combined, and more, for wages an assistant manager at McDonald's would scorn. Nobody is more overworked or underpaid. Everybody else's failures, the mistakes and omissions of parents, schools, cops, mental health professionals, lawmakers, churches, politicians, all end up on the social workers' plates. All they see all day are the terrified and the doomed whom they can't help, and nobody ever sees them at all. Until, inevitably, they drop one of the 50 eggs we've demanded they juggle at a time, whereupon we flay them alive on the front page and cut their budget a little further. No wonder each new generation disconnects just a little more. They're getting smarter, that's all. They see how our society treats those who do give a damn. Pretty soon, a day will come when we're all too smart to care, and everyone is tragically hip. Shortly after that, we'll join the auk, the passenger pigeon, and the dodo in the evolutionary trash folder. Or we could start learning to value and reward those who care. We really could, you know. Maybe one day we will. Well, speaking of those who care, I guess I'll close you out with a cheerful song by one of my very favorite amateur musicians in all the world, me. See if you can guess who this one was written to. It's called I'm Aware of You.
Take three. One, two. I'm aware of you when I'm busy at my work and you're humming in the parlor. I'm aware of you. We don't have to say a word. I don't need any reminder. I'm aware of you. Care for you, I will be there for you. Cause you're aware of me, you give me what I need. Most times before I know I need it, you're aware of me. I don't have to slay a dragon just to come to your attention. You're aware of me, and you care for me. You've been there for me. And this house is alive with your. When you're gone, it's a pleasant hotel. As I come in the door, I can tell, cause I'm aware of you. When my mind is chasing fantasies across the galaxies, I'm aware of you. As I sit at my computer, playing poker with myself, I am aware of you, and I care for you. I know you know I do. 'cause I'm aware of you.
Well, on that note, A Natural, Spider on the Web 19 comes to a close. My thanks to Colin McDonald, CrypticMusic.ca, and Brian Breeze Kaol at kaol.com for permission to podcast their music, and I thank myself for the same. Come back next week, and I'll read you samples from each of the three novels in the Lifehouse Trilogy, just out in a single hardcover omnibus from Bain Books. And don't forget to send a copy of Variable Star to someone you love for Christmas. Only you can prevent starving writers.